So we're going to get started. This is a little different talk. It's interactive, case-based, sort of very practical, about opportunistic infections. And hopefully it can be interactive among the panel, and hopefully the panel agrees with at least half of what I thought the right answer was. So I have no financial affiliations. So after attending this presentation, I hope you can sort of understand the current trends in OIs in the U.S., list the more common OIs, and describe the concept of IRIS, and identify appropriate resources. Sort of easy stuff, right? So we're going to talk about opportunistic infections and a brief history and where we are now. One of the reasons I like to include history is since I'm on the tail end of it, I think it's important that those of us who are sort of finishing our careers in HIV that started a long time ago share with you some of the stuff that still drives the whole system and drives us. And then I'm going to talk about what's new, both in terms of providers, patients, pathogens, and maybe some tools, and then we're going to do cases. So anyway, I'm going to start with a patient I took care of very briefly in 1985. His name was Pablo. He was a 36-year-old Vietnam vet. Became chronically ill in 1982. He had all the usual systemic signs and symptoms of advanced HIV. He was diagnosed with HTLV-3 in 82. His initial CD4 count was single-digit, and he died a pretty bad death in the end of 1985. We coded him wearing these sort of disposable hazmat suits. It was a very sad thing. And Pablo was a great guy. He was actually known to the hospital because he's a DME salesman. So people knew him before he got sick. He had a young family that luckily was not infected, and he would have done anything to live. So this is what, when he died, I went and got paper charts, those of you that remember the wonderful paper charts, the size of two phone books, and I went through everything we did. And if you really want to scare people, you show this at a meeting of healthcare executives. But this is the worst case scenario in terms of what happens to you if you have untreated HIV in a country like the United States that has resources. And when you look at all this stuff and you realize what happened, he really had a lot of different things happen. He had probably three episodes of PCP. It's hard to say because back then we only treated for 2 weeks. He was one of the first people to have disseminated MAC. He was in that first group that was reported. And he had all these other things. And, you know, sadly, he never received a medication to treat his HIV, and he never received any medication to prevent his HIV, to prevent his OIs. So here was a guy that was ready to do whatever he could to live. We could do nothing for him. And that's obvious in the past. So where are we now? So as you all know, OIs went down dramatically with the advent of effective antiretroviral therapy. The real question is, who's getting OIs now? But there's sort of a few classes of people getting OIs. About 20% of new diagnoses in the United States are in people who have AIDS. So technically, they are at risk for OIs. There's another subset of the population that we've talked about all day that Carlos just talked about is the people who go in and out of care. So lost to care and re-presenting. There is a group of patients that we're seeing more now than I saw several years ago, which are globally traveling patients, so people from other countries that come in maybe not as managed as well as they could have been if they had more resources, and they develop OIs. And there's actually a percent of people who are in care and despite being in care develop OIs. To the great credit of everyone in this room, when you look at most of the audit data and the site visit data for Ryan White-supported clinics, preventing OIs is not a problem. That's something, it's sort of the lowest hanging fruit for all of us, and so that doesn't really apply to us. So what about providers? So the big change, I think, that sort of drove this talk is providers are changing. The bottom line is that there's a shortage of about 500 full-time HIV clinicians. We know that 15% of practicing HIV clinicians in the United States are over 65 years of age. And so over the next few years, the cohort of clinicians who have been trained and practiced in the era where we saw a lot of OIs will be leaving the workforce. This is a 36-year-old male, Jesse. He arrives at the clinic as a new patient. He's never been in care before. You can see his HPI there. fatigue, weight loss, sort of a lot of the B symptoms that we see with HIV. He's had a chronic cough that he says he's had for years, but he knows he has a headache when he climbs stairs and some shortness of breath. Grew up in New York, MSM, moved to Memphis, unemployed, and he smokes some marijuana and occasionally smokes crack cocaine. Okay, yeah, that's what I was going to say. So that we talked about the decrease in OIs, we talked about the provider shortage, and we're at Jesse. Good, shortened up. So the thing to take out of this, he has a fever. He looks puny. His BMI is 20.6. Slightly slow response time when you talk to him. His lungs are clear. Those are his labs. You can see that he's got a pretty high viral load and pretty low CD4 count, and those are some of his serologies. So what's your next step? Start on a co-formulation of antiretrovirals, obtain a more detailed history and review of systems, obtain a chest x-ray if no acute disease, start and heart and prophylaxis, have the patient meet with the pharmacy team to discuss treatment goals, or initiate a fairly extensive workup to diagnose any active OIs. So about a third of you think you should do a fairly extensive workup to diagnose. Some want to get a chest x-ray. Good luck, guys. Who wants to take this? Mike.
Those are the results. I remember them now. So I would agree with the majority of the audience. I want to get them on antiretroviral therapy kind of quickly, but there's enough going on here that I would like to know a little bit more. For example, in the old days, when we treated with AZT alone and someone had underlying pneumocystis, once you started treating, if you didn't have them well covered with prednisone at the time you started therapy, they get worse in the first 48 hours. They become hypoxic. So knowing a little bit more about what's going on before I throw the antiretroviral therapy at them, I think is kind of important.
Anyone? Yes.
So the other issue is in a presentation like this, there may be more than one opportunistic infection, and if you had something like cryptococcal disease that could present with just a kind of fever and weight loss and so on, then that might be a barrier to antiretroviral therapy. So I think the final answer is the best answer.
Yeah, and I think the thing I was trying to get at with this question was really the sick patient who comes in, sick but not acutely ill, and who comes in with numbers that concern you. I would say of the answers that are probably not right is I don't think you can start them on antiretrovirals right away, and I don't think a chest x-ray sort of gets you out of the risk of missing something.
I mean, I think one thing to keep in mind is that when we had patients presenting late, a certain percentage of them would present with constitutional symptoms without having an opportunistic infection. And that's a diagnosis of exclusion, obviously. And I think in this setting, since he's clearly at risk given his CD4 cell count and viral load, you're going to want to promptly identify one or more opportunistic infections before starting him on appropriate treatment.
Okay.
One comment that might be institution-specific because, I'd have a high suspicion for PCP here and would probably start empiric therapy because it's actually very difficult to confirm in our hospital.
Okay. So a panel of tests are ordered. So they're doing what they call the OI flog at Vanderbilt. They're flogging him for active OIs. And in our area, we have to get histoplasm antigen as well. And they get a room air ABG. So what do you guys think about a room air ABG? Why is that something that we drill down all the time? Is that new to you guys? Is that something you tell your house staff to do? Mike, anyone?
Well, you start with a pulse ox, but if it's low, which it almost certainly is in this setting, then a room air ABG is really important. It's a forgotten art of, A, how to draw them, and at least for providers. But the interpretation is very important because of the PCO2, which people forget about. And here you're going to have a pretty large AA gradient by definition. I'll hold the other comment about things for the future, but that I like the idea of getting it.
Yeah, I just say, you know, people that can mount a tachypnea can actually have a normal oxygenation status and still have a substantial shunt, so I think that's important.
So that's sort of the point that I try to say with the trainees and the house staff is that it's very hard to tell if someone's hypoxic if they're just sitting there. And the pulse ox can cost anything from $35 to $1,200, so they're varying in quality as well.
I mean, the other thing we've done in clinical practice is to walk patients.
Yes.
If they have an interstitial process such as pneumocystis pneumonia, they'll oftentimes desaturate.
Yeah. So I think that's a great positive. I'm not 100% comfortable with it as a negative.
At least.
So what's the next step? Treat for PCP with high dose. So now you have someone who's febrile at risk. They have a large AA gradient. They have a clear chest X-ray. You either treat them for PCP with Bactrim or TMP-SMX, trimethoprim, or you treat them with trimethoprim and prednisone. You arrange further testing, and you await the other test to come back before you do anything. You go ahead and choose. Okay. So most of you would treat with high-dose trimethoprim sulfa and prednisone. Anyone disagree with that on the panel?
No.
Really? I do. So this is the problem with panels. You can't control them. So the point of this discussion, everyone's looking at me like, Steve, what are you talking about? I don't believe in presumptive PCP. I mean, unless you absolutely can't get them bronched. But I can do that, but I have to get them bronched.
Right. I think you can treat the patient empirically for PCP because that's overwhelmingly the most likely diagnosis. It does not mean you shouldn't try to establish diagnostic certainty.
Yeah.
And in our place, we'd induce sputa first to see if we can make the diagnosis that way. And if we could not make the diagnosis that way, we'd do bronchoalveolar lavage.
So we're all thinking pneumocystis. Some of us are more comfortable than others with sort of how the diagnosis is made, but ideally we'd want to go ahead and get it.
Yeah, two quick things.
Yes.
One is that for those who weren't around back in the 80s and early 90s, as Steve mentioned, a lot of people ended up having multiple OIs, and so that even in the lung you could have more than one thing. But the other thing is that there were a lot of studies during that time when, for all the world, a patient looked like they had PCP, and 60% of the time they didn't. People forget that.
Yeah.
And so just to empirically treat, not a bad start, I guess, but you could be missing something. So there's no urgency here. You want to take a little bit of time and get it right, and I think that's a art that has been lost in the age of art. And the final point I'll make, just regarding prednisone, we tend to use it only when there's an AA gradient greater than 30 or a PO2 of less than 70. That's what the guidelines say. The guidelines were based on a study done in Los Angeles in 1988 to 1990-something, and it was done because they couldn't give prednisone to people who had normal oxygenation because they thought it was unethical to give prednisone to somebody with HIV. And so that's where the rule came from. The fact is that anytime somebody has pneumocystis and you treat with, say, trim sulfa, they will become more hypoxic in the first 48 hours, no matter what their baseline PO2 is. So in my view, everyone who you're treating with treatment doses of Bactrim should get prednisone regardless of their PaO2.
That's interesting.
Just in terms of empiric treatment, it also won't interfere with your diagnosis.
No, not at all.
So some cases, you're reluctant to do that because it would interfere. In this case,
you
could still go ahead and do it the next day.
Yeah, I think, and the message that, and again, I'm influenced by the calls I get where I practice, and the message that I want to make sure people understand is that, leaving that diagnosis out without proving it is a bad. I can remember the name of someone who died of histo and someone who died of TB following that path. So, I mean, it's in 2018, we should be able to nail the diagnosis. So I'm not going to go over this. This is in your notes. Just the reason I tell the house staff, especially the ER, to get a room air ABG, it's the fastest, easiest, quickest way for me to know if they have an AA gradient. And if they don't have an AA gradient and it reassures me, I'm comfortable following them up at the clinic the next day. I can't get them, I can't get a high-res CT that quickly. There's not as much data on it. But it's a good study, but I can't do it that quickly. And I can't get them bronched or anything else. And spontaneous sputum, even if it worked in our lab would take time. Yes?
I think one thing to remind people is that PCP does not present with primary pulmonary symptoms.
Right.
So this is a classic case, and people get confused because they start focusing on the constitutional symptoms and they don't pay enough attention to the mild cough. And the other thing is, obviously, that normal chest X-ray does not rule out a pneumonitis. So you have to pursue it.
Right. And the bottom line is, I always tell my trainees, you know, if you have a febrile patient with AIDS and he's not being prophylactic for pneumocystis, you have to prove to me on rounds he doesn't have pneumocystis. Because if I stayed home and just rolled the dice, I'd be right most of the time.
So some of the HIV series on FUO using the definition of FUO pneumocystis has shown up along with mycobacterial diseases and lymphoma. So it can be
very
indolent over weeks to months.
Yeah, great. Okay, lab results come back. Patient's serum cryptic antigen is positive. CMV PCR is a little over 1,200 copies. Your next step is, and now we can. Oh, I guess, yeah. Thank you. So positive cryptococcal antigen, CMV viremia. Okay. You guys want to address this?
I think you should look in the back of their eyes to make sure they don't have papilledema, but I feel very comfortable doing a lumbar puncture if they don't.
Okay, so the issue there is whether you're putting the patient at risk doing a lumbar puncture without imaging the brain, and you feel comfortable just making sure they don't have papilledema. Other comments?
Well, we can get CTs very rapidly at our institution, and I think unless we're concerned about bacterial meningitis where you'd want to institute therapy right away, we would often do option number two and quickly image the brain, although I think the first answer can be defended.
Okay. Other thoughts, Mike?
Yeah, I think the answer number four is probably incorrect or is incorrect because you don't want to wait. You don't want to treat sequentially when they show up. You can treat concurrently. The eye evaluation is important. Now, urgent, I think, may be a better word, because if he has CMV, he could have CMV retinitis. We haven't seen that in a long, long time. Excuse me, but you don't want to have him have sight-threatening disease while you're treating these other things. Then you should really always do a CT scan, at least a non-contrast, just to look for non-communicating hydrocephalus before you do a lumbar puncture.
Okay. And most of us would think that completing treating PCP would be a bad idea before working up these other things, correct?
I think one thing to keep in mind is there were lots of people back then and probably still that have CMV in the blood that do not have end organ disease. But the other thing to remember about CMV retinitis is it involves a peripheral retina initially, and oftentimes subjectively the patients will have absolutely no symptoms and it can only be picked up with dilated eye exam.
Correct.
So at some point he needs a dilated eye exam, but if the first priority here after the pneumocystis is to deal with possible cryptococcal infection, which I think it is, then I feel comfortable proceeding with an LP.
Okay. We can go to the next.
Just one other thought is that in the brief description, there really isn't much characterization of his neuro exam.
Uh-huh.
I think there's some altered mental status. But
just a slow response time, that's all.
We haven't really heard in detail,
yeah,
and I would wish to do that.
Okay,
soon.
That's good. So he gets a non-contrasted CT scan of the head, gets a LP done, a slightly elevated opening pressure. He has four white cells, normal glucose, and a protein slightly elevated. So this has shifted to an ED physician calling me in the middle of the night and asking me, is it okay to send the patient home?
So for clarity, Steve, we don't have a firm diagnosis of PJP right now, right? We just have...
So it's sort of a mix. He's been diagnosed with PJP, and he's been treated, and we're sort of moving through time. It's a little bit constructed. So now you're being called, and the ED physician wants to know what to do. You can either follow, and you say, well, I'll see him in the clinic. We need to start him on some HIV meds. You're going to arrange follow-up after completing PCP treatment. You're going to admit him to treat empirically for bacterial meningitis pending lab results. Admit for observation pending completion of CSF results. We can switch over. Can we switch to the other screen? Pardon me? Oh.
So.
Too bad I didn't have any pull with the chair, you know, to get this done. So could we see the results of the question or the ARS going once, ARS going twice? Good Lord, guys. Well, jump right in there, panel. You're flying blind.
One is clearly not the right answer, because if the patient has suspected cryptococcal infection, it's a good way to induce a flare of it. So this is one of almost probably the only instance nowadays where a delay in initiation of antiretroviral therapy would be recommended. It's also important to note that cerebrospinal fluid white counts may be subtly elevated and protein may be subtly elevated. That does not rule it out. In fact, it's associated with a worse outcome for cryptococcal infection. Yeah.
That's great. Anyone else have anything you want to add?
Well, I think the clinical corollary to the lack of inflammation is people may not have, you know, classic meningismus and, right. and so on, so it may just be a kind of a nondescript right. fever and still have cryptococcal meningitis.
So that's sort of the message here is that, you know, it's a bland CSF, and actually the blander it is, in a way, less WBCs, you have a worse prognosis. So you really need some definitive test before you send them home saying they don't have cryptococcal meningitis. India Ink is a great test. It's being phased out because it's incredibly easy to do. But it's hard. I mean, it's not as sensitive as the newer tests, and it's also hard to do quality control in a lab for India Ink.
Several subtle points here. If you look at that Indian carefully, at about 12 o'clock at the top, you'll see a budding, an organism budding. That means that there's active infection. Sometimes later after you've treated, you can still see a positive Indian. Don't freak out about that. Those cells are probably dead. And if you don't, you probably won't see budding. And also at about 11 o'clock, you'll see on the corner on the side another budding cell. Couple other quick points while we're on it. Cryptococcal antigen will be positive universally, actually strongly positive, about one order of magnitude or one dilution more positive in CSF than in serum. So you can get that back pretty quickly as well. As far as the main thing, just to carry on from the bland CSF, what's happening biologically is that the organisms are replicating without any interference. There's no much host defense, so you get a huge organism burden, and what happens is the products from the organism start blocking the arachnoid villi. And if you remember back to biology, that CSF is produced at about 500 to 600 cc's a day from the choroid plexus and then bays down and comes up and gets reabsorbed at the arachnoid villi. And when you block the reabsorption, what you're doing is you're producing fluid in a closed space, and what happens to pressure? It goes up. It's just, you know, basic physics. And so when that pressure builds, that's what causes the headache. And typically the headache of cryptococcal meningitis is worse when you cough or sneeze and laying down as opposed to sitting up. His opening pressure was 24, which is modest. A lot of times in this setting, the opening pressure will go through the top of the manometer, and everybody freaks out and thinks they just killed the person. But the fact is, the most important thing to do in the management of this patient, besides getting them in the hospital and on treatment and delaying for about a week or so the antiretroviral therapy, you want to do serial LPs to relieve the headache. And if the headache comes back, patients sometimes will actually ask for an LP, if you can believe that, because they got relief with the last one.
And we were asked once, when are you done doing repeat LPs and you consider a shunt? And neurosurgery says when you can no longer do the LPs.
Right.
So we had one gentleman that required 11.
Neurosurgeons got much better at that over time. They saw the outcomes.
And when you say serial LPs, it's a daily LP.
It can be, And especially if it goes through the top of the manometer. In this case, I just monitor the headache.
Right.
And if the headache is coming back, then you can just do an LP. You don't have to do any more tests. Just drain some fluid.
Okay, good. So, again, this has all been addressed. The sort of the take-home is they almost never have, or they rarely have, I would say, true meningismus. You can't go by an active CSF. It's an indolent disease. I think the study that Mike was on, the big mycosis study, 30 days was the duration of symptoms before they were diagnosed. So it's not an acute disease. okay, he's started on the right meds, he has repeat LPs, everything goes wonderful, and he goes home and is discharged on oral fluconazole. 2 days prior to discharge, he started on antiretroviral therapy. 10 days after discharge, he comes to the clinic, he feels great, hasn't felt this well in a long time, he's gaining weight, he's eating. Then 10 days later, now 20 days out, he calls the service complaining of increased headache, feeling poorly, and feverish. Next step would be repeat the labs that you got before, add steroid therapy to treat presumptive iris, bring the patient in for imaging of his brain, repeat LP and follow up, continue to monitor closely in clinic. One of you guys want to address this?
Well, I wouldn't do number one, and you can't really use the cryptococcal antigen to follow the disease. You might do a combination of two and three. I agree with the audience that a repeat LP is indicated. It also might be therapeutic with the increased intracranial pressure that you see with iris. But you might also end up adding steroids if after three.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably iris, but you can't be sure. The gold standard, platinum standard for whether cryptococcal meningitis is getting better or not is a CSF culture. CSF culture. You can't get a culture unless you do an LP. You don't want to do the LP and somebody who's got a worsening headache with fever in this setting because he could have something else. Maybe he has iris to toxo or something, mm-hmm. or PML, who knows? But you don't want to stick a needle in their back again until you've shown that the imaging is clear, at least this time. It probably is crypto iris. The serum antigen is not a good test to follow therapy. It doesn't correlate at all to resolution of infection. It will remain positive perhaps for years after the initial episode. It does not mean they have active disease. It just means they've had crypto in the past. And the CSF antigen also will remain positive, but it will incrementally come down. But a CSF antigen by itself at this time tells you not much. The culture is the absolute standard. The likelihood is this guy's culture by now is negative, and he probably has iris. And you just give him some steroids and get him through this, and he'll be okay.
So quickly, Mike, what would be the findings on reevaluation that would?
So the cell count actually may be up a little bit because the immune system's kicking in, perhaps with the iris. The protein may be up. Glucose probably not much change. The antigen I wouldn't pay much. It might be down a dilution, and the. If India ink was positive before, it'll still be positive. You might not see the budding anymore. But you also want to repeat the LP for pressure, which also could be up a bit at this point if there's iris.
So if you had just a slightly elevated pressure, you do the LP. All the other things are sort of what you said. Your culture's pending again.
I would go ahead and give steroids here because I feel pretty strongly this is iris.
And I can say that in our experience, the worst iris we've seen has been crypto far and away.
So I think the purpose of the case is to illustrate iris and the management of that. I would also question the patient whether they were taking the fluconazole, the antiretrovirals, because it could just be progression of their disease in the absence of therapy.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. So just briefly, this is one of the ones you really do have to worry about iris. Up to 30% of patients have been reported. The guidelines recommend delaying 2 to 10 weeks prior to starting antiretrovirals, and they should be monitored quickly and evaluated immediately.
Sorry to keep talking so much.
No, that's
here,
good.
But
like
there's one thing about that about the delay in treatment. There's controversy because almost all of the cryptococcal meningitis antiretroviral therapy studies have been done in sub-Saharan Africa, where treatment approaches are different. They rarely use 5-FC. Sometimes they don't use amphotericin, but more importantly, serial LPs are not necessarily engaged. So a lot of the studies that showed harm, it was actually harm, with initiation of antiretroviral therapy were done in that setting. There have been cohort studies in the U.S. and Europe that have shown that the treatment early of crypto does not portend a worse outcome relative to delay. So I think what you did was perfect. I think you start the treatment without the ART for about a week to 10 days, then you initiate the antiretroviral therapy, send them home on that, and that's just fine. If IRIS is going to happen, it'll happen. You can manage it.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I agree that starting it on the front end of the 2 to 10 weeks would be ideal, but you really have to have in place kind of ability to follow that patient closely and have the ability to react to increased endocrinial pressure.
Okay. So remember, this gentleman had CMV viremia. Now he's evaluated by an ophthalmologist. There's no retinitis seen. Contrasted MR of the head just shows some mild white matter disease. So this is a good question. Basic question is, someone has detectable CMV viremia and no retinitis shown. Do you start treatment along with HARD after treating his cryptococcal disease? Do you start treatment and delay starting HARD another 2 weeks? Do you take him off HARD and put him on? Do you start HARD? Let's assume he's off HARD once cryptococcal antigen has been delayed appropriately. So the real question here is, if you have someone who has CMV viremia and no localizing signs or symptoms and that would suggest GI involvement, and their ophthalmology exam is negative, would you treat in the setting of early initiation of recent initiation of antiretroviral therapy? So let's go down the panel, because this is sort of open-ended. Mike, would you do anything about a CMV at this point?
No, I'd let the antiretroviral therapy work and the immune system take care of it.
I agree.
You agree?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can have CMV viremia without disease, and you can actually have disease without CMV viremia, and if you're going to quickly get somebody on antiretroviral therapy. The one issue that I worry a little bit about is if you end up with IRIS and then you're treating with corticosteroids, at least in the olden days, that was a concern about CMV becoming more active.
That's true.
I think the end organs to think about with CMV are the eyes, the gastrointestinal tract, and polyradiculopathy, oftentimes involving the legs.
Which we luckily don't hardly see anymore. Okay. The recommendation by the guidelines is not to treat just CMV viremia.
I saw a couple of people in the audience pointing to their... If I remember correctly, he had dysphagia on presentation? Or maybe not.
No,
maybe
I think
that
was
the first guy.
He's still the first guy, but yeah, that's a good point. But I think he was just lean.
Just that point that if you did have those symptoms, you want to rule out CMV esophagus.
This guy we've been dealing with so long, we've forgotten what he had, but it's okay. Sorry. So I'm not going to do this. You guys know all that. So this is another patient, 38-year-old, longstanding HIV, lost to follow-up, presents wasting, malaise, oral candidiasis, and skin lesions, which are shown there. He's homeless on no medications. CD4 count is 23.3%, and his viral load is over 600,000. We can go to the next question. Everyone get a good look at the lesions?
Can't tell what they are.
So the best way to diagnose this would be obtain blood for HSV, CMV, MAC, cryptococcus, and histo. Obtain tissue cultures, biopsy lesions, obtain serology for Bartonella, HHV8, and PCR. I didn't do that. God, it's like you... I feel violated in this whole talk. I do. This is terrible. Okay, you guys are all cheaters now. I see everything going up. Are we doing the ARS or not? Or do we know? Do you guys want to just take this and run with it?
I'm a big fan when new skin lesions occur in an HIV patient, especially with constitutional symptoms and a low CD4 cell count, to biopsy the lesion.
Okay, biopsy. What are you thinking when you biopsy?
Can you go back to the picture?
Yes, I can.
So the disseminated histo and crypto look more like molluscum, and these do not look like molluscum to me. When I see a purplish or bluish purplish lesion, I think first of Kaposi's, although these are quite round and symmetric, and then I think of Bartonella infection.
Okay. Anything else?
Which is bacillary angiomatosis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We saw several cases a few years ago, and the thing that's striking about BA is it's friable. So when you feel KS, it's always very firm, you know, it has that little halo around it. It's not these are very friable, and you can also sometimes.
I have a sense that this is going to be Bartonella.
How do you do that, Mike? It's amazing.
It's a magical thing that only you can get with years of experience. But I will say that the cases that I've seen personally of Bartonellosis did look like this, but they almost always had fever.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes a fever would be 105.
I mean,
yeah. These people would be real sick.
They can almost look septic
and
sometimes.
And it also involves the spleen and the liver,
yeah.
And you can get
paleosis, hepatitis.
Hepatic angiomatosis as well.
So we talked about what we do. You should be aware of this, especially if you're caring for people with advanced disease with sort of transient housing. It does seem to be more important in that setting. You should be able to at least know what paleosis hepatitis is. It's they're blood-filled sinuses in the liver and the spleen, mostly the liver. They're very characteristic, so most radiologists that have trained, you know, over 15 years ago in urban areas can recognize it almost immediately. There's very few things that look like that. And you need to do a histopathological examination of the tissue. Malcolm, 61-year-old, longstanding HIV, a lot of complicated socioeconomic barriers to care. He comes in very sick, hypotensive, sort of septic, cachectic, obtunded. He has this weird periorbital swelling, and it looked as if someone put on mascara really poorly, light purple mascara around his eye and down to the nose, but not a lesion. It actually, we actually thought we could wash it off when we first saw it. CT of the chest and abdomen shows diffuse adenopathy. Everywhere, pretty much. He has nodular infiltrates in both lungs. He's got effusions in the left base. Very, very sick guy. This is not going to be an ARS. Labs reveal these labs, so sort of consistent with his presentation. He's got AKI, probably. He has anemia. He's got a lot of stuff going on, and the things that we're going to focus on is the CMV PCR, the EBV PCR, the human herpes virus 6, which is undetectable, and the human herpes virus 8. And the UA shows some bacteria and some white blood cell counts, and he's got a positive cryptococcal antigen. He's transferred to the MICU, is intubated, and resuscitated. So what pathogen could be the cause of his entire clinical presentation? Okay. Who wants to take this? And maybe we could march down and explain whatever you think it is and then why the other ones are not.
Well, I'll start and just say that this kind of differential diagnosis of presenting with advanced disease with fever and pancytopenia is kind of a common differential diagnosis where, before getting to the diagnosis, you think about disseminated mycobacterial infection, including TB, disseminated fungal infection, including histoplasmosis, lymphoma, there are some other things, but that when you see this, those are kind of the common things that come up. Obviously, the audience is thinking lymphoma with HHV8.
Other thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with the audience here. Just by the presentation, that eye issue feels like a Kaposi's type of lesion with blockage of the lymphatic system, and that we see that a lot with advanced disease, so that would be HHV8. I thought the cryptoantigen was positive. Is that right?
Yeah.
It could be that, but we've already discussed crypto, so I don't think that's going to be the answer.
it's our first patient came back.
Right. It doesn't behave like CMV, EB virus, perhaps a lymphoma, but the E. coli, interestingly, you got the urinary tract infection, but that's probably not the cause. I will mention that if you ever saw gram-negative rods in the spinal fluid of somebody with this presentation, think strongyloides.
Yeah.
Strongyloides.
Super infection.
There's a hyperinfestation syndrome that, as it goes into the distal gut, goes through the colon and carries with it bacteria, and the presenting manifestation could be a E. coli meningitis. So if you ever see E. coli meningitis in an advanced AIDS patient or in an institutionalized person who's got inability to provide care for themselves in some way, that's what you think of. I think this is almost certainly Kaposi.
Yeah, and the reason I put this in is this is actually an old pathogen with a new look. I think we all know about KS. But there is multicentric Castleman's disease, there's primary effusion lymphoma, and then there's this new one, KIX, which is Kaposi sarcoma, herpes virus inflammatory cytokine syndrome. I recommend, if you're not familiar with this, to read it. You know, we had one case like this, this gentleman, who I'm not sure if he had KIX or he just had really bad disease, but we treated him very aggressively. It's a very uncommon presentation. I don't know about you all, but we started seeing more KS in the last year than we have in a long time. Have you all noticed that?
I saw my first case in many years recently in a patient who's virally controlled but never mounted a very good CD4 cell count response. He's in the 200 to 300 range and developed purplish lesions on his legs.
Yeah, we probably had a half dozen in the last year.
You know, what's fascinating is that we also saw a couple cases recently. And I realized when I went to make my referral to the oncologist that the person I was referring to had never seen this before, and I was probably just better off giving him the chemo myself.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm that great, but I'm just saying
I know what you mean.
You know.
Yeah, I agree. So I recommend those of us, this is one of the few things when I was reading about it, I thought, I found out about this really because we sort of made the diagnosis backwards. We didn't really come on forwards. But the more I read about this, the more I realized this is sort of a new face of an old pathogen.
I think one thing to remember about KS, if it's localized cutaneous, the treatment of choice is antiretroviral therapy.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's important to engage his HIV clinician because this is somebody who's had longstanding, presumably has been treated with antiretrovirals. He needs effective therapy. You don't know his resistance pattern, so that's going to be an important
challenge.
And you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but what I remember about this is that sometimes you can get an iris as you start treating, and the KS lesions get worse.
Yes, and you can't
give
steroids.
What you do not do is do not give steroids. Yeah. This is the one case where you have iris. Steroids makes it worse. Why? I have no idea.
But we learned the hard way that steroids makes KS much worse. Yeah. Now, the good news about all this gentleman that this case is based on is doing fine. He came in to complain about his bill last week. And he had good reason because I couldn't understand the billing either. So Juan's a 38-year-old Guatemalan gentleman, admitted for fever, chills, weight loss, abdominal pain, sort of the same stuff, increasing fatigue, dyspnea, CD4 counts low. Imaging is consistent with multifocal pneumonia. He's admitted to the ICU. He requires pressors and everything else. And the sort of the thing that was unusual about him was his massive splenomegaly and some hepatomegaly. He's treated with broad-spectrum antibiotics, sort of the whole sepsis academic center workup and response. Some of the workup that's done by the hematologist is consistent with HLH. One of you can talk about if you like. And so they thought he had HLH with underlying lymphoma, and they plan to start the HLH protocol. The way I think of HLH, it's hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis. I just think of it as a very revved up immune response that has diagnosis criteria. So they're planning to start the protocol and splenic embolization before diagnostic therapy and splenectomy. A routine peripheral blood smear revealed the underlying disease. So I can go to the next slide. It won't reveal disease, but it will reveal sort of what we're thinking about. The reason I presented this patient is, A, I did not get this diagnosis. A lab tech got this diagnosis and called me. B, I'm not very good with a lot of the world travelers that we see. I have colleagues who are much better with it, and when I presented the case to them, they were not surprised. But I think we all have to start thinking, when we're taking care of people from other countries, how that sort of changes the equation when you do OIs. So before I ask you guys what I'm just scared that I press this button, it's going to go to the wrong slide, but we'll see. So the guidelines have actually guidelines on what I call geographic OIs, which is what I think they refer to it in the guidelines, and those are the ones that are there. I added some additional ones, TB, histo, and coccidio, just thinking of geography in the United States. So would any of you like to talk about this patient?
Again, you, I think, hit on the right point that you're looking for OIs that are endemic to his home country, Guatemala.
Right.
I think the splenomegaly fact that it was diagnosed on peripheral smear leads me to think leishmaniasis.
God, you guys are good. Yeah.
Yeah. You could also make a case, I think you're right, but you could also make a case for histo as well, because it's very prevalent in Central America. I've seen a lot of cases from Costa Rica for whatever reason. You can also get the HLH picture. Ferritin is often elevated with disseminated histo.
Yes.
And you can make the diagnosis from peripheral smear, although leishmania, I think, makes more sense here, because sometimes the white cells have engulfed the histo, and you can see it in the cells intracellularly.
The other point is that globally the most common OI is tuberculosis, so if you had someone like this with this presentation,
yes,
you would make sure to
in
have them in isolation until you, yes, had excluded that diagnosis.
Yeah. For sure. So, yeah, it was leishmaniae, and it was on the peripheral blood smear. It wasn't even a Buffy coat or anything. The lab tech picked it up just looking at the slide. So I apologize for how disruptive this presentation was. I'm going to have to talk to the chair. So what's new? Well, I think there are less patients obviously presenting with OIs, but there's still 20% out there who are at risk. We're seeing more international patients. And I think, you know, I can't overemphasize how different it is when the growing population of providers has only seen a handful of cases as opposed to hundreds. You can get very sort of laissez-faire or glib about PCP, for example. But the last postmortem I went to on one of my patients, he had lymphoma, but he died of PCP. The lungs are fixed. If you feel the lungs taken out of a patient with PCP, it's like they've already been fixed. This is a horrible disease. And people are very cavalier about it now. They either, you know, treat empirically from an ER of an outside hospital, or they think they've ruled it out just because the chest x-ray is normal. There's not been a lot of changes in technologies. You'll hear about beta-D-glucan and a few other things, PCR for PJP. They haven't really changed much in what we do. It hasn't affected how we work things up. Every time you start HIV treatment, antiretroviral treatment in the setting of an active OI, it has to be timed according to the guidelines. There's not a lot that are bad, but crypto is certainly one of them, and maybe CMV and maybe MAC. Primary and secondary prophylaxis guidelines are very good, and they're updated, and also when to discontinue prophylaxis. What's old, the same old guys are going to be causing the same problems in most of our patients. You know, you're not going to see a whole new slew of OIs that we haven't seen before. The biggest mistakes that we will make in the future will be missing common OIs rather than the rare exotic. You know, I don't worry about missing leishmaniasis. I worry about missing PCP or cryptococcal disease. And when you have an immune-suppressed patient with multiple complaints, you have to prioritize what's going on. You have to work it through very methodically. You have to sort of address the things that are the most emergent and work down from there. And these are the resources. And with all that, I still finished early.
So I'd like to look at just at this panel discussion in light of the talk before it on the talk on engagement and care.
Yeah.
Because at the time that I trained, we had a 40-bed AIDS unit that had just tons of patient support. It could be somebody, they could be caring for somebody who was newly diagnosed or somebody who had not been engaged in care and now was presenting with a very serious illness. And both of those presented opportunities for engagement. Now, in the absence of that, it's still very helpful, I think, in the hospital setting to have one point person, whether it be a social worker or someone who is really going to be working with that patient to better understand their illness, the importance of antiretrovirals, and then making that linkage, whether to their ultimate HIV home. And all of the cases here were for people who were previously diagnosed, but this may be their presenting illness.
Also, I think if you go back to when this first started and we were seeing people who are so sick, there was not the pressures to get them out of the hospital like there is today. So, I mean, people are expecting to come in, make the diagnosis of pneumocystis, get them on meds, and get them out in 48 hours, 72 hours. And it may work for a lot of patients, but it may not work for all. And so this, the house staff and the physicians in training and clinicians in training, I see, are being pressured much more than I was at their stage of training. And so they're being forced into sort of decisions that may not be in the best benefit of the patients. And I think we have to identify that. I mean, you have to call people out when that, not the trainees, but you have to call the system out when it does that.
I think one other thing is to remind younger practitioners and people in training that the symptoms and signs of disease in an HIV-infected individual need to be interpreted in the context of their immunologic function. Right. And some, you know, the workup of headache in someone with a normal CD4 cell count who's virally suppressed is very different from the workup someone with a low CD4 cell count who's never had a headache before. And I get the sense, at least talking to the trainees that I work with, is that they don't think it through that way often.
Yeah, no, I agree. We have some questions. Anyone have questions standing up? No, yeah. No one wants to ask a question standing up. Okay. Is there still benefit for screening for CMV in patients with a CD4 count less than 50?
Screening, you mean?
Like drawing a PCR.
Dilated eye exam?
I think they mean drawing PCR, drawing blood for.
I've never been a big fan of drawing CMV, serologies, PCR, whatever, in someone who's asymptomatic and whom there's no suspicion of disease, because these are patients that you're going to get. It's unlikely you're going to treat their CMV in the absence of symptoms and signs, and it's someone that you're going to get started on antiretroviral therapy and put them out of risk, most of them, fairly quickly.
Did you have something, Mike?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the in the pre-ART era, the thought was if you had a CMV-negative person, you could perhaps counsel them about avoiding CMV, right. CMV-negative blood products, things like that. It might, but I think in this era where we can at least get people above 50,
yeah.
even if they don't fully immune reconstitute, I think the importance of this is less. Many individuals are CMV seropositive to begin with.
So I guess the question is, if someone's got a T count of 25 and you're seeing them, you know, and you're about to sort of embark on a care relationship, this is going to be a new patient, do you want to get a CMV PCR to make sure they don't have maybe peripheral lesions in their eye that they're not aware of before you start HIV meds, which may cause iris, which can cause, you know, iris and uveitis as well? So no one here would do that? No.
Don't.
I just want to. That's fine. What is the role of beta-D? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's okay. I just have a quick case in something I never heard before. So a 26-year-old male diagnosed in July with AIDS with a CD4 count of about 50 or so, viral load about 300,000, never sought care, was hospitalized for PJP in August, again in October, and in the middle was in the ER for VZV on his left flank, treated with 7 days of Valtrex and did fine with that. So he comes out of the hospital the second time, second PJP diagnosis, and just literally they drive him over to my clinic and walks in to see me. And so as we're scurrying to get records, I called the ID doc that'd seen him. So he'd not been on steroids for his PJP. It wasn't that bad, whatever. Clinically, he looked fine. He'd had a low-level CMV viremia of 6,000. I repeated that. It was 2,000 with no intervention or medications. Toxo IgG was negative. Blood culture for AFB is actually still pending. Serum cortical antigen was negative. Obviously, his CMV IgG was positive. So that day, I put him on Biktarvy, and I sent him for a dilated eye exam. We got that appointment within about a week or so, and come back in 4 weeks for labs, although I was just kind of worried about him. So I brought him back actually in a week just to look at him. Everything, again, was no complaints, looks fine. Unbeknownst to me, the ophthalmology provider had delayed his appointment that we made by a month because they were moving their office, and so they'd canceled a whole bunch of patients, and no one ever seemed to tell us. So he walks in for his four-week appointment with some complaints in his right eye, and, of course, I immediately think he has CMV retinitis. They weren't going to see him actually till the next week, so I called another doctor that I knew that saw him that day and called me and said he's got porn in his right eye, and it's from, so I'm waiting for the CMV to drop, and he goes, it's from VZV.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so this particular retinologist said, well, everybody that's ever had VZV anytime, anywhere should be have their eyes screened. And I just never had heard that. Yes, no?
What you're describing is that entity exists and it's sight-threatening and is a sort of an ophthalmologic emergency and needs to be treated urgently. I think it is a good idea, just in general, that if somebody has CD4 count less than 50, at some point, get them a good eye exam by the ophthalmologist, not to look for the PORN, but just in general, it's not a bad idea. I didn't answer the CMV question that you just posed because I don't know the answer. All that stuff happened in an era before those tests were available. Yeah. We use them all the time now in transplant where you're creating chemical aids, right? That doesn't go away because you're going to keep them immunosuppressed, and that's a whole different animal. So I don't know. I think it's probably a good idea. I don't know if it's in the guidelines to do that, but I think it's probably good practice. You did the right thing sending them over there, just didn't get there on time.
And you could not have predicted that even from his presentation.
Well, and that's what somebody else said, but I just felt bad because
no.
No, you know. You're absolved.
Okay. Well,
fine. Said the Jewish guy.
Hi, Karen Beckerman. I just wanted to mention a case that I had extremely briefly. A pregnant woman lost a follow-up, came back in bad cough, sort of bronchitis symptoms, and desatted when we walked her up and down the stairs. She was about 30 weeks. We admitted her, evaluated her chest x-ray negative, and I asked her to induce sputums. I got hit on the knuckles by the ID fellow who said, because it's going to be negative, and then we have to bronch her, and I don't want to bronch her. And I said, you know, she could be very, very sick, back and forth, which is we face this all the time in my field. Finally, she went for induced sputums. The first sputum was screamingly positive with PCP. And I'd just like to say that it's such a pleasure to hear this session. Tests are judiciously ordered. Imaging is not over crazy or anything. And that's the exact treatment that any pregnant woman would need, if not somewhat more aggressive. So just as a message to everybody, the lady's pregnant, you don't withhold.
Right.
You are more aggressive and more concerned because these ladies go fast. They look great until they code. That's all. Thanks.
No, I appreciate that. Go ahead.
Hi, I had a question. We've recently seen a few cases of people who've had ring-enhancing brain lesions, positive serum, toxo, started them on toxo therapy, but also just looking to see if there's any, you know, again, with the length of stay being an issue, to wait to see if they respond to toxo therapy. Neurosurgery, radiology is hesitant to biopsy. If there's any updates on approach to a patient like this.
I mean, the traditional approach has been to start them on effective anti-toxo therapy and to reassess them clinically and radiologically in a couple of weeks and see if the lesions have regressed, and if they don't regress, to undergo brain biopsy. I don't think that's changed over time. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Kristen.
Yeah. Just and effective antiretroviral therapy.
And effective antiretroviral therapy.
One caveat. A serum toxo antibody, if negative, almost rules out toxo. So that's one thing that you could use in your favor early on to convince the neurosurgeons to biopsy a little earlier. But otherwise, most people have a positive toxo antibody, so then I think that's the right course.
And in one of the studies, they suggested there was a response to therapy, a clinical response as early as 5 days, and all those that had lymphoma actually declined.
Careful about steroid use because that's going to make the lesion better.
Yeah.
Right. No matter what.
In a subset of people, if lumbar puncture is possible, that's helpful as well. Our last case of toxo was a positive PCR from the spinal fluid and also would help you look for other causes of mass lesions, but with the caveat that it may not be safe in some individuals.
Can I make one comment about induced sputums? It's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The utility of them is really correlated with the experience of the person that's inducing the sputum.
Mm-hmm.
So if your institution has someone who doesn't know how to induce sputums, the yield is not going to be very good. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if we stop doing them, they're never going to be useful.
Yeah.
So it's a reasonable first thing to do, especially if it doesn't delay ultimate diagnosis.
Usually for us, it's something we do while we're waiting for a pulmonary to see the patient and sort of follow through. Go ahead.
My question is on one of those cards, so you can discard that card. My question, sort of on the same topic of CNS disease, I recently had a patient who had pretty extensive nocardia in the brain, and there was, and he was off his meds, and there was a question of when to start his ART, thinking about iris, and there wasn't great guidance for that, and so I was curious, sort of in these other conditions that don't have as clear guidance as, say, crypto or TB, what you use when thinking about CNS disease and iris in those cases?
Yes. there are no data, but I think it's reasonable. You're going to treat with some sort of sulfa-based regimen for nocardia, and I don't know the answer because I don't think there are data. Whatever you feel like doing is probably okay. Yeah.
So I would recommend, you know, in those ones that it's, you look at the guidelines and there's not a clear indication, if it's something that you haven't seen frequently but there's a known expert nationally, those are really easy phone calls or emails. I mean, people are very good at getting back to you. So we did that a lot with Joe Wheat and Histo in the early days.
So I'm sorry. So I was answering the question regarding the steroids. As far as length of therapy, you probably want to treat it long-term with some, at least trimethoprim sulfa suppression, just like you would PJP, because you're going to be treating, you're going to be trying to prevent PJP anyway, so that drug will be on board. I did something that provoked you, and you're coming back to the microphone.
Sorry, I just didn't want to yell at you. No, I just meant as far as timing of ART initiation and
ART.
Steroids, right? So you've got sensitive disease in the brain.
As Emily Latella would say, never mind. I think early. I don't see any strong reason not to. I don't know what other people think, but yeah.
Well, I think the data that we have about the timing of antiretroviral therapy with CNSOIs is really TB and cryptococcal disease. There are some anecdotes with other disease. I would have probably a general caution in other things like CNS toxo and CNS nocardia, which, as you point out, is actually not addressed in the guidelines, even though we've seen cases.
I think CNS is different because, you know, someone's MAC flares up and they may get nodes. Someone else's nocardia flares up in their brain.
1 week.
Because I think, you know, for TB, you might wait 6. Yeah. For crypto, you might wait 10 days, as we mentioned. And so I think it's – and these were community providers asking me the question. I think there's not a great –
Yeah, there's not, but I think
TV's immediate.
My colleagues here might feel differently, but the other thing that I do is to look at CNS penetration of their antiretrovirals, and it's not something that I always remember which to do, but I just check in terms of, is this regimen something that has good CNS penetration?
Okay, I have a couple questions about iris. One is, do you stop antiretrovirals in the setting of iris? And is there any class of antiretrovirals that can put them at risk for iris? And the other one is, what's the role of steroids in iris?
No, you don't stop the antiretroviral therapy. Yes, you treat with steroids with the exception of CAPAs. One thing we haven't talked about is PML.
Is what?
And you'll very often see improvement initially and then worsening with PML at like 4 to 6 weeks, and it's almost always iris. And you can repeat an MRI, and it looks god-awful, that you need steroids immediately. So I'd say the rule of thumb is steroids always, with the exception of KS is generally correct.
And there is not really an antiretroviral that we think of.
Yeah, but don't stop the antiretroviral.
Right, and we don't think there's one that predisposes more than another. That was the other question for iris. And we saw that dolutegravir did not.
Oh, right. So I showed those data yesterday, that there's no difference in the incidence of iris based on the ARV regimen.
I think there are some settings that where iris is milder and you know might be manageable with non-steroidals or something like that. I don't like the use of steroids in people with advanced disease.
So right.
I think
right.
You kind of reserve the steroids for.
And the actual protocol for iris for steroids is not 100% the same all the time, so you can adjust that. One last question: what's the role of beta D glucan in the diagnosis of PJP, PCP, PJP?
Well, we've anecdotally used that. We've anecdotally used a PJP PCR as well, but I still think the primary method is induced sputum or BAL.
Okay.
And it, you, the beta-D-glucan cross-reacts with other fungal infections. I think it's...
Yeah, I think that some of my colleagues think it excludes pneumocystis if it's normal. I'm not sure that data is really there. It certainly doesn't help anything if it's abnormal because we have histo, we have everything else. And I always say, what do you care? You're still going to have to get the diagnosis, you know, so it doesn't affect much what I do. Any other comments, questions? Okay, well, thank you very much, panel.